May it please the Court. My argument this morning will focus on the counsel waiver issue that is raised in our brief. During the Feretta inquiry in this case, my client Damar Rome made the following bizarre, if not delusional, statements in response to the judge's questioning. First, that jail guards were having sex with his co-defendant, who was also the state's star witness, and that the guards were stealing his mail. Second, that his attorneys, Walter Peel and Mr. Aharkey, had been actively trying to prevent him from attending court hearings, that they were in collusion with the prosecutor, and that they were racist. And third, that he had the exceptional ability, essentially, to represent himself, and as he put it, he had the mass amount of sophisticated evidence supporting his defense. The judge in this case, instead of probing into these questions or these comments made by Mr. Rome, instead conducted this hearing through a series of leading questions and, in fact, interrupted Mr. Rome when he would make these bizarre, if somewhat delusional, statements. And went through a standard Feretta colloquy that you would conduct with someone who was not suffering from a mental illness until he obtained yes answers and answers that I understand to all of the questions the trial judge thought were relevant. The Washington Supreme Court held that while Judge Kessler had the discretion to consider Rome's mental health history, and to inquire further, he was not required to do so, and his failure was not an abuse of discretion. This opinion is an acknowledgement that Judge Kessler failed to consider and explore Rome's mental health condition in determining whether Rome actually did understand the significance and the consequences of his actions. This is made clear in the state Supreme Court opinion when they address ground three of the personal restraint petition, and this is at ER 44 and 45. They begin that discussion by stating a trial court may consider a defendant's mental health history and status when competency has been questioned, and they're using competency in the generic sense, even where the defendant has been found competent to stand trial. Then they go through what Judge Kessler did, the colloquy, the questions he asked, the warnings he gave, and then they conclude by saying, well, there's no abuse of discretion here. It bears repeating that nothing precludes trial courts from inquiring further into a defendant's ability to waive counsel when mental health concerns are present. The Supreme Court made an objectively unreasonable application of well-established Supreme Court law when it found that Judge Kessler was not required to probe into the history and circumstances of Mr. Rome.
Let me ask you to focus on that, please. So where, I mean, Feretta says the judge has to satisfy himself a waiver is made with eyes open. And in the last 40 years, there have been other precedents from the Supreme Court touching that, right? But which case or what precedent do you rely upon that you think is unreasonably, objectively unreasonably applied?
Well, I think it starts all the way back with Johnson versus Zerbst, which requires in a counsel waiver situation that the court is required, that the decision depends upon the particular facts and circumstances surrounding the case, including the background, experience, and conduct of the accused. Now, the more specific case is the more recent case from the 1990s, Godinez versus Moran. And Godinez is the case where the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, said there's no different standard for competency for waiving counsel, entering a plea, or for trial. But at the end of the opinion, Justice Thomas was very careful to remind other courts and practitioners that there is a heightened responsibility on trial courts which consider a request for self-representation from a defendant who is competent, but has mental health problems in his history. That's Mr. Rome. They go on to say the trial court has the serious and weighty responsibility to determine whether the defendant actually does understand the significance and consequences of the decision to waive counsel. So it's not about the advice given to the defendant. It's about what the defendant understands. The Supreme Court has not given trial courts discretion in this area. It's not like a trial court can say, well, I'm just going to go through a colloquy, but I have this information about the person's mental health problem, and I really don't have to probe it. I don't have to go into that.
But if I could ask you, though, in terms of looking, I agree with you that really the colloquy is not necessarily the words that the judge says, but the responses that the defendant has in terms of evidencing, understanding, and any sort of hesitation in their agreement to go or their desire to waive counsel. But isn't that, I mean, ultimately, isn't that when you read the entire transcript, that's what the defendant indicated? At the end, he says, I know what I'm up against. And he acknowledges that he can follow the rules of evidence. He said that he's practiced law for 2 years. I'm not quite sure what he meant by that. And it's interspersed with all of these things about maybe his paranoia or his delusions as to what was happening. But interspersed between that, he clearly responds to all of the questions. What do we make of that?
He does respond to the questions. He says he understands. He says that repeatedly. In fact, he makes grandiose statements about his abilities. But what the court has to determine, and this is clear from Godinez, is that he actually understands and has an understanding of the peril that he's in, not just the words he's speaking. And what Godinez also says is when there's evidence that the person has a mental health problem or mental illness, the court has a big responsibility to probe further. There's nothing in the cases that limits a judge to just considering the colloquy. In this case, unfortunately, the competency hearing that had occurred earlier was conducted by a different judge, and Judge Kessler, while aware of the fact of a competency hearing, was not privy to many of the details that were presented at that competency hearing. And what I would suggest is when it says the court has a duty to probe, the duty to probe means to find out, well, what is it that's wrong with this guy? What is the nature of his mental illness, and how does it relate to the issue I'm deciding today, not his ability to assist counsel, his competency to assist counsel at trial, but whether he actually has a knowing and intelligent understanding of his peril and what he's doing. And that failure to learn about that history in detail is one of the things that is an error here. There are other things that the judge did that I think go to the issue of the
counsel, could I interrupt you before you leave this point? Because I just would like a little help with it. What is it this judge knew about that history, and what tipped him off that there was more that he should learn?
Well, the competency hearing was completed on June 8th in front of Judge Canova. On June 9th, they appear in front of Judge Kessler at a hearing where Mr. Rome wants a new lawyer.
Yes, I understand.
The lawyers at that time give Judge Kessler a very thumbnail sketch of what happened at the competency hearing.
Right, so that's actually the genesis of my question. So what tips this judge off? You're asking the judge to do more.
Well, two things.
Look deeper at this Feretta hearing. So
I think there's two things. One, assuming he remembered what was stated at the June 9th hearing when he conducted the Feretta hearing 3 months later on August 30th, Rome's statements during the Feretta hearing, what are apparently delusional statements about guards having sex with the witness, the main witness, stealing his mail, and tying that to his reason for why he wants a new lawyer, at a minimum, Judge Kessler should not have interrupted Rome. He should have asked him to explain to him how those concerns relate to his decision to proceed without counsel. He should have also made further inquiry of what the nature of the mental problem was and how that might interfere with the ability to make that knowing and intelligent waiver. And in fact, had he done so, he would have learned that at the competency hearing, Walter Peel, the first lawyer, gave the opinion that Rome was unable to rationally receive information, process it, react to it, and rationally attach significance to things he is told by other people.
Did he know that?
He did not know that.
Has the Supreme Court said he's required to read that report or ask about that report? I mean, you understand the standard that you're up against, so.
The Supreme Court requires a thorough and probing inquiry. In fact, I think the Von Moltke decision, which I cite in my brief, in 1948 Supreme Court decision, did not deal with a mentally ill client, but they talk in those terms. I think there were at least two circuit opinions that I've cited, United States versus Cash, which is not an AEDPA case, dealing also with an individual who had a personality disorder, a severe personality disorder, really talked about those issues of the judge probing and emphasizing again that it's not the questions, it's the actual understanding.
Okay, counsel, you're over your time, so I'm going to have to ask you to conclude your argument. You did not, you know, save time for rebuttal, but our questions kept you going quite a bit, and so I'm going to give you an extra minute for rebuttal so we can get your perspectives after the Attorney General argues.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Okay, Mr. Sampson.
May it please the Court, John Sampson, Assistant Attorney General for the respondent. Your Honors, what Mr. Rome's counsel is now arguing is essentially the claim that he had raised in the State Supreme Court and in the District Court, but then abandoned when he filed his opening brief. He made a claim below in the State Court and in the District Court that under Indiana versus Edwards, the trial judge had an obligation to not only inquire into whether Mr. Rome understood he had a right to counsel, understood what he was giving up by the right to counsel, but actually go farther and inquire into Mr. Rome's competency to plead counsel or to waive counsel before he waived counsel. That is a claim that he has abandoned, and I would submit that it's not proper for him to pursue it at this point. But even if he did pursue it, that is a claim that requires the creation of a new rule, and it requires that is not based on the holding of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court in Edwards, which was issued after Mr. Rome's judgment became final, said a trial judge may inquire into whether the mental illness affects his ability to represent himself, but he's not required to do so. So Mr. Rome is asking this court to go even beyond Edwards versus Indiana. In this case, this was not simply a leading question where the defendant answered yes or no. The defendant actually engaged in some in-depth conversations with the judge. The defendant told the judge, I am charged with first-degree murder. The defendant told the judge, this is a Class A felony. The defendant was able to recall a prior hearing that he had with the judge the first time he indicated he had wanted to proceed pro se, where he had told the judge, I have studied the law in the past. He said in the hearing where he actually waived counsel, as I told you before, I have studied law in the past. He told the judge there was only one charge of murder. When the judge asked the prosecutor, are you going to add any charges? The defendant told the judge, there's only one charge because there was only one victim who was killed. The defendant said, I understand I may not be able to win an appeal. I understand I could possibly get convicted of murder. I understand that. That's at excerpts record 302. The judge warned Mr. Rome that he was making a bad decision, that the judge was a lawyer, and if he had been charged with a crime, he would hire his own lawyer. During the first hearing, Mr. Rome actually indicated, you're a judge and a lawyer? I didn't know that. Then in the second hearing, when the judge repeated that warning, he said, I understand that. The judge complied with all that was required of him under Supreme Court case law, under Feretta versus California and Iowa versus Tovar. The judge found as fact that Mr. Rome made a knowing and an intelligent waiver of his right to counsel. And the state Supreme Court affirmed that. And that state Supreme Court decision was not an unreasonable application of then existing Supreme Court precedent. And for that reason, habeas relief must be denied.
I have a question for you. And this may be off what you've thought about. So if you can't answer it, don't worry about it. But, of course, the state puts a lot of stress on AEDPA and on the idea that even if there's some problem here under a rule argued by appellant, if it's not a rule set by the Supreme Court, you know, even if it was a rule that our Ninth Circuit set, that we couldn't give relief in a habeas case. And my question is, though, if you just looked at this Feretta colloquy alone without the AEDPA lens, like if this case was coming up to us from a federal district court, would you say the colloquy was adequate or inadequate in the way, you know, in the judge's non-response or response to some of the rather off-the-wall statements that that were made by Mr. Warren?
Your Honor, I would submit that it would, even if this was on direct review from the district court, this would still be an adequate colloquy. Mr. Rome did make some strange comments.
He hadn't studied law for 2 years, right, counsel?
Well, Your Honor, I think what he was referring to was as a jailhouse lawyer, because this was not his first time in the system. He had studied law the way a jailhouse lawyer would study law. He wasn't saying, I went to law school for 2 years.
Okay, so I shouldn't have interrupted because I was happier with Judge Gould's premise, which is that there were some off-the-wall statements. Why don't you take it from there and answer the question? I'll stay out of your way.
Yes, Your Honor. I think what Dr. Durham pointed out in his testimony in the competency hearing kind of addresses this issue. And he pointed out, and this is at excerpts of record 144, there's a difference between a bizarre and a non-bizarre delusion. A bizarre delusion is one that has no chance of being at all possible in reality. A non-bizarre is one that could possibly occur, although it's most probably did not occur. And his examples were of a bizarre one would be when you're born, there's a microchip put in your head, and that will determine how you grow up, and aliens are controlling it. A non-bizarre is one that could actually happen. And unfortunately, a female prisoner may have sex with guards. There are occasions when guards do steal mail. Those are non-bizarre statements he was making. And I would submit that judges hear those statements more often than not, that an inmate standing trial will get up and complain about his conditions of confinement or complain about things that are occurring or complain about not having mail. And what the judge was focused on was not those conditions and not possible defenses to the trial, but do you understand you have the right to an attorney? Do you understand the dangers of giving up that right? And the judge would ensure that he understood he would be held to the rules of the court. And Mr. Rome said, I have a copy of those rules. I understand they apply. I understand I have to make objections.
Okay, but isn't Mr. Rome's counsel point, though, under Indiana versus Edwards, that there was enough in the record to indicate that he may be of such a degree of mental illness that he might be competent to stand trial, but inquiry had to be made whether he was sufficiently able to represent himself? And so he's saying he's asking him the standard Feretta questions that we all ask defendants when they say they want to waive their right to represent themselves. Did he need to go further than that is really the issue.
Well, Your Honor, under the AEDPA lens, no, because that is not a rule that's clearly established. But I would submit, even if this court were considering a federal prosecution, no, it's not something he had to go forward. He did have a finding by another judge that he was competent to stand trial. And the focus in that competency hearing was not did he understand the proceedings against him, but could he assist his counsel?
Right, but was he severely mentally ill where he couldn't represent himself?
Right, and we already had a judge finding a fact that he could assist his counsel. And the judge, Canova, pointed out there's a difference between his ability to assist counsel and his willingness to assist counsel. And he was a person who was not willing to assist counsel. And I would submit that, yes, Mr. Rome looking at the trial transcript, asked some very strange questions and made some strange objections. But those, I submit, go more to his skill as a practitioner and not to his rational mental state.
Counsel, before you leave the podium, could I just ask, I think I'm remembering correctly, but I'd like you to correct me if I'm wrong. His IQ was measured twice, once at 49 and once at in the low 70s, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and there's some suggestion in the record that he may have not exerted his best efforts on the IQ test, but my question is, was that allegation made as to both IQ tests?
I think it was made as to the second IQ, but I am not 100% certain on that, Your Honor. But I think the indication was there was an agreement. He's not a very intelligent person. Whether he is mentally retarded or borderline mentally retarded or whether he is above that level, that was kind of I think the statement by the mental health professionals that he may have actually been able to score higher if he wanted to. I think that went to the second test, but I'm not 100% certain.
And the second test was the lower one?
I think the second test was the higher one. But I'm sorry.
But it's not your recollection that comment or that suspicion went to both tests?
I don't believe so.
Okay. And then my last question on this is that at the Feretta hearing, did the judge know about those IQ tests?
I can't say that he had specific knowledge of those IQ tests. I know that he acknowledged that Judge Canova had found him to be mentally competent, but whether he knew about the specifics of the IQ test, I do not know. I do know that the State Supreme Court had all that information before them when they ruled on the claim.
Yes, thank you.
And for the reasons I've already argued and in our brief, I would ask that the court affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sampson.
Thank you, Your Honor. One point I think I need to make that's absolutely clear, I think it's both misled Mr. Sampson and perhaps the court. This is not a claim under Indiana versus Edwards. We have abandoned the Indiana versus Edwards claim. I think the existence of Indiana versus Edwards helped to confuse things, but that we clearly raised a separate issue in the PRP. It was the third ground for error that dealt solely with the question of knowing an intelligent waiver of counsel. When the Supreme Court dealt with that issue, I believe they became confused with the Indiana versus Edwards case, which held that assuming the person's competent, assuming there's a knowing and intelligent waiver, they could still impose counsel on you had the discretion to impose counsel on a defendant who they thought was not mentally able to represent himself. Mm-hmm. This is a different question, and that's where the Supreme Court here got it wrong. The trial court does not have the discretion to ignore the defendant's mental illness in making the determination whether there's a knowing and intelligent waiver of counsel. The discretion does not apply in that circumstance, and that's where it's an unreasonable application of well-established U.S. Supreme Court case law.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We congratulate both counsel on fine arguments, and the case of Rome versus Fraker shall be submitted. So thank you both again.
Thank you.